Good morning and welcome to day two of Plug Challenge. My name is Scott Delucky with Breakpoint. I'll be your host for the next little bit. For all you folks over here, I have very bad news for you. I'm not going to vary much from right here where I'm standing. So as my mom used to say, I'll make a much better door than a window. If you find yourselves thinking that that's going to be a little challenging, you want to move to another area, I wouldn't blame you at all. A couple of things as we go through. First, do be sure to fill out these evaluation forms and turn them in at the registration desk downstairs. There's a box there for you to put those in. That is how the folks who helped put together the Plug Challenge decide whether or not they want to have some guy like me show up again, or whether they're going to charge me a fee more than usual in order to do that. If you hear a session that's really fantastic and you say, boy, that was great, I'd love to hear that again, they'd like to know that because when they get good stuff, it makes them happy. If you hit a session, though, that you say, this just doesn't really hit the mark, they want to know that too because they don't want to repeat those kind of things the second time around. So do fill that out. Do be brutally honest, because if there's something that's off target and you don't share the fact that it was off target, when they do it again, it's your fault and not theirs. So help them get on the right track. One other thing to pay attention to as well, listen carefully to the sound of these going off during the presentations, because when you hear one of these going off, what you're hearing is the sound of somebody who's volunteering to pay your ticket to Plug Challenge 2015. So pay close attention to them. Now, if you don't want to have a room full of brand new friends, then move to silent mode to vibrate, to even live a little dangerously and turn it off for an hour. I promise the world will not end in the next hour. If it does, you're not going to be able to hold me to my promise, so I'm safe either way. If it is really that serious, you know that they will find you anyway. All right, enough of the logistics getting forward. So, what we're going to do in the next hour here is I'm going to share my blood, sweat, and tears. A little bit of background. This presentation is about the joy of taking a progress application that was developed a long time ago and saying, since this was developed, progress has changed. There are new features and things out there. And maybe we can take advantage of that. So let me get things lined up here if I do everything the proper way. Come on now. There we go. So I'm going to set the stage, give some background on what generated this presentation topic, share the things that I learned along the way of going through this. This is actually a case study of me managing one of our products over at Breakpoint. And then wrap up with some final thoughts and some things that you'll hopefully be able to take away with you. So first off, my name is Scott Delucky. I've been a presenter here at Plug Challenge at various user groups on the Progress side, the QAD side. I'm on the board of the Midwest QAD user group and the South and East. I do a bunch of stuff. I get around. I do a lot of things in the Progress community because I foolishly believe that if there's enough stuff going around here where the community is valuable and useful for you, you'll stay around. You'll be here year after year, event after event, and sooner or later, we'll get a chance to work together on something. It may be later, but you never know for sure. Breakpoint, I usually talk about as well. We've been around since 1987, originally as United Systems, now as Breakpoint for the simple reason that nobody else had a name that was close to United Systems, close to Breakpoint. There was somebody else who had a name that was close to United Systems, and one time in Atlanta, they got a check from one of our customers. Someone decided that wasn't a good idea. So Breakpoint was picked, and the reason was nobody else had a name like it. I have since found out there is one other Breakpoint out there. It's a dog kennel in Ottawa, Ontario. Hopefully you'll never get confused as to which one is which. How about you folks? How many of you are developers? How many of you manage those developers? Okay, and how many of you are here for the beer? Almost as many. All right, so give some background here. The guinea pig, what I'm going to talk to you about, is the ADU. This is one of Breakpoint's products that we have that is focused in the QAD world. It's a product that automates and the deletion and archiving process within QAD, batch processing, and a few other things. It's used by a number of QAD customers. We originally wrote it back around 1999, 2000, around that time frame. It was essentially written with version 6 style coding practices, fitting into a QAD world. QAD's been around since actually since 79. They started using Progress with MFG Pro in 1984. First issue of version of MFG Pro came out in 86. That predates version 6. So suffice it to say that the Acuity standards have been evolving for a long, long time and support a lot of the coding practices that were state-of-the-art 30 years ago. One of the things we do at the ADU is we support a variety of different Progress and Acuity versions. The current version of QAD is 2014. The oldest version that I know of that a customer of ours have had was version 7. And version 7, just to put it in perspective, was released somewhere around 1997 or 8 in that time frame. So I got a lot of ground to cover in terms of versions of QAD as well as Progress that I support, as well as different QAD user interfaces. Character, which has been out there forever, GUI, and QAD's new .NET version interface as well. Some of the things that I'm going to share with you are strictly Progress related. Some of these are QAD related, but the ones that are QAD related, there are some nuggets in there that will be helpful possibly for you in dealing with other applications. How many folks here do work in the QAD world? Oh, 7 of you. All right. Well, you're going to get a lot out of this next hour. The rest of you are going to get a lot as well. You just have to work a little harder in some areas. All right. So, the challenge that I've got is, and probably kicked off this project overall, I mean, Progress is essentially bulletproof if you think about it. You can take version 6 code and run it in a version 11 environment, and by and large, it's going to work. Progress has been very good about that. Let me rephrase that. Yeah, going to work is accurate. Is it going to be blazing fast and accurate and wonderful? Maybe. But the gist behind what Progress has done is been to make sure that old code, old coding styles are compatible. They will work or function, really. But not necessarily the best way to do it or easiest. So, QAD has a new user interface, a .NET user interface, where standard character version 6 style code no longer works. And they also have a new version out. The version that they've been using since it came out in 1986 is called Standard Edition now. There's a new Enterprise version, which has a whole host of other different things internally. So in order to support the product under QAD's new environments, I had to go through and make changes to support the new world. And I said, while I'm doing that, why not update some of that old coding practices? Why not take advantage of the new things that I can do in Progress and make life a little bit easier? At least that's my theory, my fantasy, whatever you want to call it. And underlying all of this, there's one common goal that I have, which is one set of code to rule them all. Currently, for all those different versions of Progress and QAD that we run with, I have just one set of source code that, based on a couple of different things that I'll share along the way here, allows me to maintain one set of source code no matter what version and characteristics the QAD world has that I'm dealing with. And I want to make sure I keep the same thing here because, quite frankly, I'm a bear of very little brain. I can only focus on so much at any one time. And if I have to keep two or three different versions of code running through, I'm going to get lost and confused. So my goal is to avoid that entirely. Have just one set of code that works no matter what environment I'm dealing with, and just have a few parameters that I can tweak to allow to compile and execute properly in that environment. So that's kind of my challenge overall. When we wrap up here, we'll see how I did in the challenge. So, a word about my learning. This starts with something a few people around here may know. I'm a drummer by avocation. I do it for fun and enjoyment. I have an electronic drum set at home. And that's so that when I get the urge to play drums at 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock at night, my wife doesn't come down the stairs with the sole purpose of ending my life. So far, it's worked. My first drum kit was an electronic drum kit. My first electronic drum kit is actually a picture of it right there. It was really cool. It was great, fantastic, and wonderful. I spent hours setting it up and getting everything going. And when I had it, then I started learning things about what I didn't know beforehand. Any other drummers in here by chance? Good, a couple of folks. One of the things that I didn't realize is that electronic drum kits have two different ways you can play the hi-hat. That's the two cymbals that are stuck next to each other that you usually hit to keep a steady beat going throughout a song. There are two ways that you can set those up on an electronic drum kit. One is basically binary, it's open or closed. And the other is variable, where depending on the position of your foot, it can be partially open, partially closed, you get different sounds. This drum brain doesn't support variable hi-hats. I didn't know about that until I played with it for a while and figured out what I was missing. There are also things like dual zone cymbals, where I can hit two different spots on a cymbal and get two different sounds. I didn't know about that. I learned. So part of what took place in my drum kit was starting off with this and saying, oh, geez, if I had only known that, I would have done something different. My drum kit today is just a little bit different. It's not a nice stock color picture of me there. I now have variable hi-hats. I have dual zone cymbals. I have chokeable cymbals. I have all sorts of good stuff. And my wife still has not come down to kill me yet. Although she has said I need to shut the door because even though it's electronic, it still does make some noise. Part of the gist for this presentation going through is going to be yesterday, evolution into what's next, and then the next generation, what comes after that. Because part of the process that I've gone through here is saying, here's what we did originally, here's my first pass at the best way to do this next. And what, I guess it's a sad commentary on me, but what I found routinely is when I introduce a new version of the software out into our customer base, we inevitably have a conversation with the first customer or two when I install it, where I introduce some new features and they say, wow, that's really cool. You know what'd be nice? And they come around and give me some ideas and I'm going, where were you when I was designing? Come on, where were you when I was trying to put this together originally? Because I didn't think of that. So what usually happens is I have an idea, I put it in play, and someone comes and says, you know, you can make it this way, it'll become better. And so then you have the next generation, what comes next? So what you're going to see in going through these different areas is exactly that. I'll show you where we started, where we went to, and then what the future is going to hold, because none of this stuff is ever really done. So, first area, in the areas of learnings that I'm going to share with you. The mighty 4-H. Anybody ever use a 4-H? Yeah. It's great stuff. It's a fantastic querying tool. It's simple, it's easy to work with. A bunch of things over there, multiple indexes going in there, you can have conditional criteria. One interesting and challenging thing is the fact that indexes are fixed at compile times with your standard 4-H query, or your standard 4-H. And it's based on all the criteria that you have in there. Progress basically takes a hold of it, figures out what's in there, and says, okay, based on what you are asking for in your 4-H, here's the best possible index for you. But it's not asking based on values, it's based on possible values. In the next session, Mike Losky is doing his presentation, I'll call it famous pick an index, any index presentation. He's updated it to, I think the title now is, You Don't Know Everything You Need to Know About Indices. So, from an index perspective, it's gonna be a worthwhile presentation. Anybody ever see code that looks like this? For each, every single possible piece of selection criteria, I can find all in the entire world, put all in one place here. All right, for those folks who are close enough to read, what do you notice about the index selection criteria, all these elements that I have here?
Full index scan.
What's that?
Full index scan.
Why would it be a full index scan?
Because it has variables in here which are greater than equal.
Good point. Because there are variables in there, you're gonna add something else?
Well, I was gonna say the not equal also, you know, but they're not comparing exact fields to exact values.
Yep, not equals, greater than equal to, less than equal to. Anybody else have anything else I notice in here? Tim?
You've got that rather unpleasant use index phrase.
Oh yeah, the evil guy down at the bottom. How many people use index? I have. Occasionally, it is useful. Whenever I do use it, I document the living daylights out of it because I know nobody behind me is going to believe it. One of the things about indexes that Mike will probably talk about in his talk is that what Progress will do is they look at all this stuff and it says out of all these criteria, I can make an exact match on anything with an equal. So I've got an equals on domain, part, and type. So out of all this stuff, those are the leading components it can use for an index, and everything else is just fluff. It's going to be a full table scan after that, depending on what index it picked. And whoever put this together said, I don't trust it. use this index down here, which I actually took a look at that index last night just to make sure. The leading components are domain, which we have, and part, which we have. But part may or may not be filled in this particular query to the table. So if someone doesn't put the part number in, then we do indeed have a full table scan, and life will be miserable. And all the other garbage in there. So that's some of the joy that lives out there in a version 6 type coding world where things didn't exist. I got a little bit better. Anybody ever done things like this, thinking that somehow you would make life easier? Check the value and conditionally put it into the criteria. Cool. Except it still does the same thing. It's going to build, do the query based on all possible index values, not what you're actually using. Joy. Efficient, it will not be. So, what we did is we moved into the query. We started switching as many things over from a for each with all that nested garbage in it into a query. Query is a very powerful querying tool, which kind of sounds redundant as I think about it. Looping requires a little bit more effort to go through. It'll handle multiple indexes, and you can put conditional criteria in there. The best thing about a query, though, is that the indexes are picked at the time that the query is essentially opened. So that can be based on all the criteria that you put in there. So the basic steps of putting a query together: you define and create it, build and prepare it, navigate it, stuff it, close it, and delete it. And I put this up here because I remember going through and putting this in all these different programs. These are the different things that they needed to do. Define it, basically define your handle. Define a variable, QString is what I like to use, query string, because again, I'm a very, very little brain. Put that together and build that up, and that's what I'm going to actually use for my query. The handle is what I'm going to reference it with as I go along later. When I create it, define that query and assign the tables that I'm going to reference as part of this query. So I can build that up. If I need to have conditional tables in there, I can do that as well. Build it up. Start building up QString. For each, in this case, TTDisk, I'm working on a temp table. And what I'm doing here is just very simply, depending on what the sort criteria is, I'm putting in a conditional Y in here. I'm either sorting it by reason by department or by department by reason. If I can put this in the query, and so depending on how the user wants to run this particular report, it's going to sort it the way they're looking for. A debug hint for you, because this has bitten me a couple of times. Once you think you've got your query string prepared, put a little debug statement yourself to display what it is. Because more than once I found that what it is not what I thought it was going to be. And some little things, like the fact that there's a space before this quotation mark here, I refuse to comment on the number of times that I put this together, not have a space there, and I now have a new progress keyword called no lock by. Which progress then says, I don't know what you're talking about, Scott, go away. So debug trick, display it as you're going through in your testing process just to make sure that it's doing what you expect. As I'm fond of saying, do what I want, not what I told you to do. And this is how you make sure that you have the same things in place. Prepare it. Once you've got QString all set up, go ahead and prepare it, open it, and go grab your first record. Then you can start navigating through, which is the next step. Do while not, QDisk query off end. Basically, query off end says, I've reached the end of available data. Okay, process all my stuff, and once I'm done, I can get out of here. And then the last thing I have in here is get next. So basically, I'm opening my query, reading the record, doing my stuff, and then get next record cycle on through. Back up to the top to say move on out. Stuffing it, I just kind of, whatever you're doing along the way. So in this case, depending on my distribution sort, if they wanted it sorted by reason, then I'm displaying reason first in the leftmost column. If they wanted it sorted by department, I'm displaying department first in the leftmost column. So the display is going to be contingent on the way that they wanted to see the data sorted to make life a little bit easier. Whatever kind of stuff you need to do in the middle of your query, just put that in there. Once you're done, be sure you close it out. It's always good to clean up after yourself. I have a 14-year-old and a 17-year-old. That whole cleaning up after yourself thing is apparently really optional at that stage. And when you're all done, go ahead and delete it. Make sure you clean up after yourself. If you don't, there is a possibility of memory leaks where you're leaving queries out there, redefining them all the time. You'll find that out when somebody runs a really big report and things crash. So that's why I've got the 8 steps to go through in there. Define it, build it, create it, prepare it, navigate it, stuff it, close it, and delete it. All right. So one of the things along the way, next generation though, this works and it works just fine, but the process of regrading and every single report that I have to put together is becoming monotonous. And when I decide to make a change in something, I have to go back and revisit every single report, it is going to be more monotonous. So what I'm probably going to end up doing is looking to put it in some sort of a generic procedure that I can reference or call, so I can pass in the information that's needed to build up QStream, to build up queries and execute them. One of the things I'm probably taking a look at for that is Tim Keene's Query Manager. For those who don't know him, Tim Keene is one of the founders and the coordinators of Bug Challenge. He's also the president of the Ontario User Group, and he's made a number of the tools that he's used over the years available in the OpenEdge Hive. OEHive.org, if you've never been there before. One of those is his Query Manager, designed to manage and control queries and do all of the 8 steps. Define it, create it, build it, prepare it, navigate it, stuff it, close it, delete it. So designed to handle all those things. Because just as I go through and get things going through, there's always something you can do to tweak it, make it just a little bit better. All right, next area, navigation. Standard QAD functionality has up and down arrows to go through records, cycle through them. The QAD standard has been to use editing blocks, which were really cool back in the late 80s, early 90s. And they've got a next previous routine that gets called. The code looks something like this, prompt for your field editing, do your stuff in there, reference that, and life goes on. It's really cool, it's really old and deprecated, and it's really interesting to work with. I mean, it's effective, it does the job. And as evidenced by the fact that it's been around and being used for 20 plus years. But it's not necessarily the easiest way to go through and handle things. We have this really cool new thing that was introduced in Progress called session triggers. And actually I want to call this procedure triggers, not session triggers. That's part of my fun. Event-driven code. When I do an up arrow, do this. When I do a down arrow, do this. Wow. I can put stuff in like that. I can do things like, in addition to just a simple up arrow, I can say, okay, if someone hits Control N, I want to go to the very last record in this possible query. If they do Control Home, I want to go to the top. You couldn't do that with those up and down arrows. And a side piece on that, when I first showed the first customer, I introduced that, the Control Home, Control N stuff. Because we have this log that always starts off with record one, I always type a bunch of nines and an up arrow to get to the last record, which is the one I care about. I put all this Control Home, Control N stuff in. The first customer I showed to it said, why don't you just sort it in reverse order and display the last record first? Where were you when I had my brilliant idea to squash it and tell me the right way? So what I did is replace the session call. So in essence, what I've got are things like this. On down arrow, do whatever. Find first available, if available, do this stuff, run display else, calling standard QAD message for an end of file because there's no farther down that I can go. Return null apply to get out of here, make the down arrow not be an active key happening inside the main program. Same functionality, but now I have control over exactly what's going on. I feel better. I have much more flexibility and control over exactly how things are going to go in here and what I want to have happen next. Next generation, though, is going to be to take this stuff and put it as a generic routine. Because again, recreating this for every single program is getting to be monotonous. And developing every new program, again, it's getting to be monotonous. I'll make it persistent as well. I'll possibly take a look at Tim Keene's Procedure Manager, one of the other tools that he put out there on the OpenEdge Hive. Or, based on sitting at Tim's playing with OO events presentation yesterday, may take a look at event objects and see about doing something like that in there. That may make it challenging for the supporting one version of code for everybody, because events I think came out in 10.1 of Progress to be able to define an event. But that's why it's for the next generation of the future for figuring out how to make that happen the next time around. All right. Now we're going to drive over into the QAD world specifically for a little bit, supporting QAD's .NET user interface. Anybody else admit to being a chewing dinosaur? I have company. By people.
Not a dinosaur.
What's that?
Not a dinosaur.
That can be discussed later, Tim. Life is certainly easier if you follow standards going along the way, though. So, I've been coding in Chewy style for a long time. It's simple, it's easy to work with. There is cool stuff in the new things available, and QAD's .NET user interface, they finally got some stuff. Enough stuff in there, I say, you know, even though I can do this a whole lot faster in character, that's got some merit. And we really need to, I decided we really needed to support that interface. So, a couple of things I learned along the way. Things that I used to use all the time, status messages. Status, default, whatever. Danger, Will Robinson. They work fine, or easy way to display things, show information going along. You can't use them with the .NET user interface with QAD. It just causes grief somewhere along the way. I don't know the exact technical reasons why, but it's along the lines of fire bad. Don't do that. So, what I did is I discovered QAD has their standard messaging routines, which I came across, I showed a little bit previously. But one of the really cool things they've got is a generic message routine. Message number 8585 has no text to it. You simply pass in a variable with what you'd like to have it say. So I just set up standard practice, error message equals danger Will Robinson, call message 8585, passing an error message. QAD handles all of the background stuff, and I essentially get a status display without having to do any hard coding or special efforts. I do confess that I have a little text file saved that has the coding syntax for all these various things that I need to do with the QAD standard messages, because I can really never remember them from one day to the next. And things like, how many double quotes do I need in a row there? Why do I need four double quotes twice in a row? I don't remember. I did look it up once and investigate, dig down into the depths of the code to figure out why. And I don't remember what I came up with other than, yep, you need to. Just go ahead and do it this way. It has all the status, all the user interface, across all of QAD's interfaces. So character, GUI, .NET, handles everything for me. Next generation around, I'm probably looking at setting up my own set of messages so I don't have to just rely on the generic approach. The message numbers are what QAD uses internally within the database, so I'll start using my own set of error messages. The challenge is going to be picking a range of numbers that QAD is not going to use. And it's time to go back and crack open their standards documentation and see if, by chance, they might have set aside a reserved area that I can play around with. Of course, as soon as I do that, any other person who's developing stuff in the QAD world can also use that same area, so now we're going to have to fight between us over who gets control. We'll see how things go in that regard. One of the other nice things about using standard messages is that it supports language translation. I can create the same message translated into a different language, one record per language, and QAD will, based on the user's language, display the appropriate version. So, I haven't fully rolled multiple languages out yet. Actually, I haven't done it at all. But that's in the future plans to support to make things work in that regard. All right, message boxes. Anybody ever use a message box? Message view as alert box. MVB in the GUI editor. Nice quick way to interrupt, and again, not supported by the QAD.NET UI. Yay me. I'm so happy. What I ended up doing was essentially have to build up a frame with variables and display that, just like you would a message box. So what I do is define a bunch of variables. I really create a vform one through however many I need, initialize it to whatever text I want it to display, and then just go ahead and display the variables inside that particular frame, and life goes on. Then I can do the interaction with whatever I need to have the user do after that. And so it's inconvenient, to say the least. And this is certainly an area where I'm looking for the next generation to follow along. What's that going to be? Generic forms. Some kind of way to do this more easily. Some kind of a persistent form handler. Mr. Keene, I'm so glad to see you in the back of the room. I'll be looking for your form handler manager over in OE Hive somewhere in the near future. All right, labels and languages. This is, again, part of standard QED stuff, but it's things dealing in other environments. Labels on things, whatever it's coded at, easy way to define and set things up. QED has long ago started using their own include files with whatever the language code is for that particular thing. T001.I is basically the word to, depending on what language you're dealing with. Somehow magically inside there, it checks up, looks up your language code, finds out the appropriate spelling, if you will, of the word to, and puts that in there. That sets the groundwork for supporting the languages, just like in the other area. You do need to translate your labels. If you translate the word to the same way in every single language, then it's going to show up the same way. This isn't translating on the fly, but it is a good thing to take a look at along the way. Next generation here, we will be adding in language support there. I'll let QED handle that behind the scenes. All right, now we're going to step away from the QED stuff, specific stuff, a little bit. And let me give a preface into this new area. We have been using one set of code to support multiple versions of QED for a long time. We've done that using preprocessors. Peter talked about in his last session about preprocessors, Gus having said they're the worst thing that he ever invented, or something along those lines. I kind of like them. They're useful when put in the right place. So what I essentially do is, depending on QED versions, I know what the idiosyncrasies are between different versions. And so I've got preprocessors defined, but I set to true or false depending on whether or not those apply to your version of QED. And then what I do is, when it, within my code, I have different things that say, in this case, if domain check is true, so if they're in the QED version that has domains, I'm going to run this set of stuff. If it's false, then I'm going to run other stuff in its place. And that way I can have one set of code. It's not quite fully one set of code, because I do, in some cases, have the majority of the query or whatever duplicated. But at least they're in the same place, and I can tell clearly which one is which and how I need to behave. It makes life a whole lot easier. All right, so so this is kind of an introduction, a preface setting for this next area here. And I apologize, this is back into QED-specific stuff. I mentioned that QED made some changes between their standard edition and their enterprise edition. The big monster change that they made is they changed the structure and layout of the source code directories. For 30 years, the source code has been in a directory called source, encrypted code in an XRC directory. And when you reference, when you called something, you simply called it and it found it and ran. With Enterprise, they have now decided to split the source code up in two character subdirectories, just like they do for the executables. So now I have to do USMF, MFMSG.I in order to call that particular routine. And the part that makes this fun is that not all, almost all of QED's routines follow the same process, which is whatever the two character code in the front is, that's the name of the two character subdirectory. There are, of course, a couple of exceptions, just like to every rule. In this case, MFDeclare, which is used in just about every single QED program, is not in the MF subdirectory. It's over in USBBI. And so you have to remember what those hand, there's about 25 exceptions that are stuck someplace else. So you have to remember exactly what those are. This source code structure layout affects everything and causes challenges with anything that you want to run. Subroutines, includes, anything that goes in and processes. So what I did was I decided to use preprocessors to do this. I set up another check preprocessor, EE check, Enterprise Edition is the simple abbreviation for theirs, and set it to true. And then what I do is I have a file that's called it sets variable. So if enterprise check is true, then I define another set of preprocessors, in this case USBBI and USMF, equal to the string of what that should be. So US/BBI, US/MF. You can tell I keep things simple because I don't want to have to remember too many things. If EE check is not true though, I just define those and put nothing after. That defines them and leaves them blank with no value whatsoever. Then what I can do If it's a standard edition include now, I call in USMF, call my preprocessor in here, and because it's blank, it just is the same as calling MF message, and it'll go ahead and run it. If I'm an enterprise edition, it's not blank, and now it's going to pick up USMF MF message or USBBI MF declare. So I have one set of code that simply I just have one set of code that says whatever this preprocessor is plus the actual call I need, and leave everything else behind the scenes. I take care of everything else in the definition process where I set up the preprocessors themselves. The alternative is having to go into every single program and make these changes and remember which one's which all the way across the board. Actually, when I finally got this all ironed up and ironed out and set out, it took me, I only got about 60, 80 programs in the product overall I think I had to go through. But it took me about a day sitting inside of Notepad++ to go ahead and change this, because I basically had a bunch, I opened up a handful of programs, global search and replace within these programs, anywhere where it says bracket MF, change the bracket USMF, and so on and so forth. It was a whole lot more exciting when I was sitting there doing it, not having a title, just being robot mode, basically. All right, what's the future going to look like? I don't know. There'll be something there in the future for this. I just haven't come across it yet. Will there be ways that I can do this in some other fashion? We'll see. Next area, database layout. I said the product was originally developed back in 1999. Multi-volume databases were optional. How many people had either had customers or reached the point of filling up that 2 gig database? I was out on a sales call once, meeting with a customer for the first time, an ancient machine, slower than molasses. It took 5 minutes for the prompt to move from field to field in the display, because the hardware, everything was so underpowered. I looked at their database layout, just kind of looked at the structure file, and lo and behold, they had a single volume database, and the database was a variable extent that was currently 1.85 gigabytes in size. I said, you're playing with fire. They said, really? I said, you've got 150 meg of space left before your database goes all over the place. So we got one of our DBAs in to help them out and to move it over and everything else. Fun and exciting. Back then, that whole multi-volume thing was an optional step you could do if you thought you really needed to. We went and moved our way over and moved our way to type 2 storage areas. I want you all to take a look at this. Those folks can read up in the front, because I know from the back it's going to be a little bit tricky to read. This was our original structure file. I had to dig back to find an original structure file from way back in the 2000 timeframe. Because we actually didn't even give out structure files back then. We just created the database. This is the current type 2 storage area structure file we're setting out. Anybody notice anything about that? Anything jump out to you? Yeah, we separated out the schema. So that's out of the mix here. What's that? Yeah. Am I right to call this type 2 storage areas? No. I actually just realized that this morning when I put this slide in here and added it, and I was taking a look, I said, holy smokes, all my cluster sizes are 1. Anything with a cluster size of 1 is by definition a type 1 storage area. I've been using this for the last 5 years. And with a cluster size of 1, thinking I was putting in type 2 storage areas. Well, I can tell you this morning, for the next release, I've now updated, we are using a structure file that actually has type 2 storage areas. This is trying to make things a little bit more in control. Now, it's how many folks have made the migration from type 1 to type 2 storage areas? Those who haven't, it's a fun exercise in trying to figure out what your data really looks like. I'm doing a simple split here with static and log data. The logs are the only thing that really grow within this particular database. It's the only real transactional data, and splitting between data and indexes, just to keep the two in separate spots so they can be managed. Typically, an index, at least last I recall, you would set with a cluster size of one, and dating itself with a cluster size greater than one. Tim is shaking his head. What?
Records per block.
Records per block one. So yeah, I'm way off. That's part of the reason why in the future, I'm going to really use Type 2 storage here, is revisit that, because apparently I was having a real good night when I laid that out the first time. And it could stand a little bit of review. Horizontal partitions. How many folks have attended the horizontal partitioning sessions here? That's some really cool stuff. Really neat way to be able to break apart the database. I'm not sure if we'll take advantage of that. The largest one of these databases that I've seen in production is 25 megabytes in size. I don't know that horizontal partitioning is going to buy me anything. But you never know. I might do a further breakdown, separate out different tables in there. We'll have to see what the future holds in this regard. All right. So seven areas running through along the way there. Any questions before I hit you with my final thoughts? Tim.
Maybe you can talk a bit about the advantage of Type 2 storage area.
Tim's comment is talking about the advantages of Type 2 storage area, which I did not do in here. I'll share my evolution of storage areas with my favorite analogy, which is a bucket of sand. If you imagine your database being a bucket and your data being sand, then the original single volume database structure prior to type 1 or type 2 storage areas was you put your sand in the bucket, that's the database, and then you had indexes to go find it. And that's everything was mixed in there, you never knew where it was going to be. That's how things went through. When types 1 storage areas came out, what they basically did is you had a bucket in there, and you had the ability within the bucket to say, I'm going to set aside, I'm going to basically put little baggies in here. I have a baggie in here for my static data. And I have another baggie over here for my static index information. And so when I go to query something, instead of looking at the entire bucket, I can just pull out the particular baggie with that subset of sand that I need. And I can take the big stuff, the transactional data, the monster tables. Every database has one or two or three that represent the large part of the database. Those can be off on by themselves. They don't infect anybody else by taking up their space. What type 2 storage areas let us do is say, I like the baggy concept, but I still have to deal with individual grains of sand. Wouldn't it be nice if I could pick out a connected string of sand at a time, and that's the blocks per cluster. So 1, 16, 64, and 512, if I remember my numbers correctly. How many blocks can be in a string? So when I go to pull out a cluster of data, when I reference it, I can grab, if I grab a cluster of 512 blocks, those are going to be contiguous. I'm going to read through and pick those through so I can process that data by itself without having to jump around on a disk, without having to access a bunch of different areas. Likewise, if I want to delete information, I can just say, okay, blow away that entire cluster, and all those blocks will be handled at the same time. I don't have to go through block by block. Processing is a whole lot faster. For the large storage areas, for your large transactional tables, it's just really handling efficiency that goes in there. For the other areas where you have, for example, static data, where you've got 50 tables in here, because they're all static and they don't change much, each one is its own unique strand. So when you pull it out, you get just that particular table's information out of all the other ones that are in it. It's kind of like a sub-storage area inside the storage area. And it improves performance quite a bit. You have to set it up properly and not do foolish things like leave all your cluster sizes at one, because that's when you're back down to grains of sand. I love discovering things like that. All right. Other questions, comments, thoughts? Well, if you do have them, I will be around for the rest of the conference here. A couple of things to wrap up with. My final thoughts. First, my mission status when I started out. Support for QE's new .NET UI. Got that done. Support for new QE version. Thanks to preprocessors and tweaking the code around. Got that taken care of. Did I update some of that old style thoughts? You betcha. Do I still have one set of code to rule them all? Happily so. Is mission accomplished? Well, not really. I did all those things, but there's more stuff. There are more things to take a look at because I've not done everything that progress has that can bring you fully into the 21st century. I'm really not dealing yet with interacting with web activity. It would be really nice to set something up so that my customers could just go to a web page and query and see what the status is of their ABU process that's running. I don't have that ability yet. They can go in and query it, but they got to do it within QAD. It'd be nice to take that outside. It'd be nice to do it, have a mobile interface to do things, because same thing. I want to check it on my phone, which is kind of going the same way in there. Improve the browsers. A lot of browsing querying is still version 6 style browsers, just kind of with a little bit of extra lipstick on them. They work, they're functional. Can they be better? Can they take advantage of more things? Absolutely. Looking at adding some truer .NET functionality in there. Fully embracing things. QAD itself is moving away from character. They've stated, of course they've been stating that for about as long as people have been saying that COBOL is going to die. So I may still need to support it for another couple of decades. And then whatever progress comes up with next, whatever they're going to have to wrap up things, whatever they're going to introduce next time around, that I'm going to want to take advantage of and say, what will my customers do? One of the things I'm very proud of is that in the 14 years that I've managed the ADU for Breakpoint, I've never turned down a customer request for an enhancement to the product. I firmly believe if a customer says, I wish it did this, well, first off, they're right. They do wish it did that. Whether or not I think it's a good idea is beside the point. They think it's they'd like to see it, and it's my job to investigate, see what that means, and see how we bring that in there. I will tell you, not all things get done immediately on the development list. Some things have to wait for me to figure out, okay, now how in the blazes am I going to do that? Some things do take time to put through. But my ultimate goal is that if a user says they want something, some other user probably does as well. And it's in my best interest to make sure I satisfy everything that my end users are looking for. I will admit that there is one request that I've halfway satisfied, and that was the electric chair interface to deal with certain end users who do things like leave their sessions logged in for hours on end, leave records locked and go. I'm sure none of you have ever had to deal with people like that. Legal advised me that I could not formally put the electric chair interface into play. However, at the end of the routine, if the ADU process itself fails for a reason, like somebody logged in like that way, we do have a user exit routine that you have full control over, where we'll pass in the offending user's name. So we've left the spot for you to put your own electric chair interface in there. Just, I don't really want to hear about it. Plausible deniability and all of that. All right, and one final thing. My next generation drum set. Because the one I've got, I still don't know what I want to do and improve and make that a little bit stronger. I'm just looking forward to it, that's all I can say. With that brings me to the end here. If you'd like a copy of this presentation, leave me your business card, write the word Century on the back of it so I know what to send to you. I believe it will eventually be posted out to the Puck Challenge website as well. But I'll be happy to send it over to you. If you have any questions about anything I covered in here, please feel free to give me a shout. Either contact me via my information on here, or see me here at the rest of the conference. With that, brings us to an end, and I believe next on our agenda is lunch.